Aliens grant a man superpowers he doesn't fully understand. He wants to use them to help people, but isn't quite sure how to go about it. And the results are good, but not great. Which makes Ted Anderson wonder,
why is this not a movie?
Hello, and welcome to Why Is This Not a Movie, the podcast where we look at a moment in history or a book or a story we can rip from the headlines and ask Hollywood why no one's ever put it onto the big screen. Joining me this week is comics writer Ted Anderson, who's written comics including Side Effects, The Spy Who Raised Me, and numerous issues of My Little Pony and Adventure Time. Ted, thanks for coming on the show. Tell us about why we need a low-key superhero movie, but Paul Chadwick's comic series Concrete.
So this is a little bit of a cheat, because there have been attempts at making a Concrete movie before. There was at least one script put together sometime in the early mid-90s, I think. And I think there may have been a TV pilot possibly even produced within the last like 5 years, but it's obviously never been picked up. And I think that's a shame, because Concrete does something really special in comics and potentially could do it on the screen pretty well. Not every comic translates well to the screen, but I think Concrete could really do it for a variety of reasons. So some quick background. Concrete is the work of Paul Chadwick, who's not a super prolific comics artist, but a well-known one. He started off at Dark Horse in the late 80s. And Concrete is his most consistently produced book. He's done some other things. He's done some art for, I think he's done something for Marvel. I'm not entirely sure. He did another book called Three Wishes. Oh, I forget the name on it now. But Concrete has consistently been his project since 1988, 89, whenever he started. Originally, it was a 10-issue series, a continuing series from Dark Horse. Then it became a series of mini-series, as well as short comics in the anthology series Dark Horse Presents, which were like 8-page things. And it's been him the whole way through. He's written and drawn every page of it. And his art is, first of all, gorgeous. And I think that's part of what we'll talk about as to why I think it would translate well to the screen. But it's also, I mean, low-key is definitely the word for it, because it's a weirdly humanist fantasy for a story about a guy who can lift boulders bigger than a car. So very brief introduction to the series. The idea is Ron Lithgow is kind of a schmuck. He's a speechwriter for a senatorial, Senator Douglas, kind of a progressive type. But his wife is divorcing him, and he's kind of a sad sack. He and his buddy Michael go on a camping trip. They discover a cave with some weird, strange technology in it. They're knocked unconscious, and when they wake up, their brains have been transplanted into gigantic, 8-foot-tall, golem-like bodies that are totally sexless and made out of something that resembles concrete. Their captors never explain why they've done this, and they are then put through a battery of bizarre tests of their endurance and their strength and so forth. Finally, they manage to break out. At the last moment, Michael has a change of heart and wants to try and stay and see if they can retransplant him back into his body. But Ron decides, you know, he wants freedom more. He jumps out. Shortly thereafter, the mountain explodes. The alien ship flies off into the night sky and is never seen again. Ron uses his connection through the senator to kind of make a peaceful contact with the American government, get himself tested, prove that he's not a danger. And then essentially, he's kind of left to his own devices. The NSA basically says, you know, we can't really hide you very well. And also we can't really stop you from leaving if you really wanted to. So we're going to make you into sort of a C-list celebrity type. We're going to exploit the hell out of your image by putting you on every talk show there is and making, you know, kids' toys and party favors and stuff with your face on it. And then you'll just kind of be left to be, oh yeah, there's that weird rock guy who lives in Los Angeles, I guess. You know, people remember you, but not particularly think much about you. So the status quo of the series is, after all this has sort of died down, Ron is now living as Concrete, this 8-foot-tall rock dude in Los Angeles, with his NSA doctor, Marine Vonnegut, and his personal assistant slash writer editor, Larry Monroe. And there's a bit in that first volume where he basically makes an appeal to the American public. He puts out a video where he says something along the lines of like, look, I want to be an explorer. I want to be somebody who tries to save people or do things to better the world. He has a very strong social conscience. And a lot of his stories are all little one-offs of him kind of finding somebody, seeing how he can help them, and then trying to help them with his bizarre alien biology. And that's a big part of it. So he's made out of concrete. He has no genitals. He's strong enough to lift, you know, a car over his head. And he's also, this is a cool aspect of the super strength thing that I like. He's not just strong, he has incredible endurance. So he can lift like a truck over his head and then hold it there for like days at a time. He can hold his breath for an hour. He is essentially invulnerable to anything short of like a gun. Like, and even then that takes a few shots to actually do anything. Oh, and then there's further mutations to his senses where he has no sense of touch, essentially. He has no sense of smell or taste. His hearing is normal, but his eyesight is vastly improved. So he can like read a newspaper by candlelight from across a room. You know, he could count the feathers on an eagle's wing as it flies overhead. And all of this makes him into someone who is sort of a, he is someone who is more suited to being an observer of life than someone who is able to actually participate in it. That's sort of a major theme to a lot of the concrete stories, is this idea that he has become something that's able to experience all the beauty and wonder of the world, but never really participate in it.
One interesting thing is they keep coming back to, like, he's a speechwriter in his everyday life before this happens.
Yes.
And they come back to that often, that, like, that he's a writer and he's good at describing these experiences he's having. And that kind of seems to be his biggest skill, even yes. though, like you said, he can lift a car over his head.
Yes. And that's, I mean, in some of the books, they also do a thing where he'll be, like, writing up his, you know, recollections of the incident for a book or an article or something. And in some cases, he sort of goes into a situation intending to be a neutral observer and then ends up being less neutral than he thought he was going to be. But yeah, I mean, he is an observer first and foremost. And there's all this lovely dialogue. There's this, you know, incredibly great voiceover that he narrates what he's seeing and describes the wonders of nature that he's experiencing in very flowery, very excellent prose. And he is, I mean, he's inspired by adventurers. He's particularly inspired by, I'm trying to remember, I think it was Bird. There's Arctic explorer.
Burton.
Burton. That's yes. And he, you know, he always felt like he wanted to be an explorer, but never quite had the physical capacity or the drive to do it. But now, of course, he can do things like try to swim across the Atlantic or climb to the tops of Mount Everest or do all sorts of incredible things. So yeah, the stories are generally just sort of concrete, finding something interesting to observe, but interesting is a very broad term. There's a weird comparison that I realized when I was thinking about Concrete, because he's actually sort of a spiritual counterpart to another early 90s comic book figure, which is Hellboy. He and Hellboy kind of play off each other in an interesting way. Hellboy, of course, also being a Dark Horse creation, mostly tied to one creator for, you know, the entirety, well, for the majority of his existence. But of course, Hellboy had several movies made about him. So that's, you know, I think there's even another video game about him coming out right now. But Hellboy, I mean, Hellboy is a, you know, very blue collar, salt of the earth, you know, guy who goes around punching demons for a job. He, you know, he finds skeletons or zombies or whatever. He punches them out. He goes back and has a beer with the other soldiers. He's everybody's pal. He's a very affable character. And, you know, depending on how many memes you've seen about Hellboy floating around, you may have seen a panel being shared where he's holding a bottle in one hand and pointing angrily off panel and just saying, "Don't mess with me, lady. I've been drinking with skeletons." And that kind of sums up the Hellboy ethos. Yeah, Hellboy is a very kind of affable character and a very, you know, friendly guy. And it's also, I think the notable part is that Hellboy is someone for whom the supernatural is mundane. He's constantly fighting, you know, giant weird monsters or witches or strange beasts from beyond reality. But to him, it's just part of the job. And even if he's sort of impressed by the size of the monster, he's just like, well, you know, I bet I can punch it to death.
That is one thing that I would like about Hellboy and just stories that acknowledge that, like, this wild, fantastic stuff is commonplace, because after a while, it's like, how many times can you say, like, this can't possibly be supernatural, Mulder, unlike the last 15 supernatural things? At some point, you should be like, okay, this is the world we live in.
Yes, there really are aliens out there. There's, you know, alien dissections happening every place. I did like also, I always like the episodes of The X-Files where Scully thought it was nothing, Mulder thought it was aliens, and then it actually turned out to be some completely bizarre other thing that was, you know, a lizard man from the sewers who ate livers every 23 years, whatever it was. I love those episodes. But yeah, I mean, for Hellboy, he's approaching the supernatural as sort of a job. He just goes out there, he does it, he's good at it. You know, he comes back and he has a beer. For Concrete, though, he approaches the mundane with a sense of the supernatural. Well, not even supernatural, but the sense of wonder, a sense of real, you know, intrigue and fulfillment. And this is, I think, a large part of where Paul Chadwick's art comes in. Paul Chadwick has a very, very strong, I think painterly is maybe the word to go for it. It's all very fine line, but it's very delicately colored. And unfortunately, the reprints that they have are black and white, which really sucks because the coloring is beautiful, delicate stuff. But you have to track those down in quarter bin issues and that kind of thing.
The frustrating thing is I ordered this for the Kindle just to save time so I could read as much of it as I could before the episode. And it's also black and white and it doesn't cost anything to color anything if it's digital. Yeah.
It's digital. Like, it shouldn't matter. So it sucks. But at least all of this stuff has been collected. Like, so just to give a rough timeline, he started doing this in 1988 or 89. He's done miniseries. The last miniseries was produced in 2005 or 6. And then there have been 3 short stories since in 2012. And everything except those short stories have been collected. Everything is in print at the very least, but it's kind of a shitty print because it's also sized down. It's smaller than a, you know, regular comics page. Anyway. But yeah, I mean, Paul Chadwick is a very painterly, but also very precise, very technical. He loves to give every last little detail of, like, you know, the chips in the doorframe of Concrete's home because he keeps banging his head or his arm on the side of the wall. You know, the shape of the wooden walls, or the, you know, the specifics of the armchair that Concrete has built for himself out of cinder blocks. Everything has these very lovely, precise little details, and it's very, very realistic, and it reminds you that, oh yeah, there's this bizarre 8-foot tall concrete golem walking around in what is otherwise the real world.
And I think the, like, Concrete super eyesight just seems to be, yes, an excuse for him to draw incredibly detailed things every once in a while.
Yes. There's a bit in, there have been two, like, versions of the origin story told. And in one of them, I think he wakes up with his hand over his face, and as he's pulling it away, he's like, God, I feel like I'm looking at the surface of the moon, because he doesn't understand what he's seeing, but he has this incredible detail into the texture of his hand. Anyway. But yeah, I mean, and there's other interesting artistic flourishes where there's one of the Concrete stories is about Concrete joining an eco-terrorist movement as first as an observer and then eventually getting pulled into the actual movement. There's a lot of detail in the ecosystem, you know, the various animals that have been placed in an environment. He'll give, like, little tiny little scroll text telling you what the name of each species is. There's this beautiful 2-page spread, which is kind of disturbing, which is an image of a fishing net with all these creatures tangled in it, and they're creatures which in some way correspond to the 12 constellations in the zodiac. And he's seeing, you know, this pair of twins, and then a fish, and then the pair of scales, you know, all these creatures tangled in this beautiful array of disturbing death and decay. It's phenomenal. It's like the artwork is really a strong part. I mean, the writing as well, but, like, the artwork is phenomenal as well for the same reasons. It's a meandering kind of series. There are stories that are much more mundane in, like, the very literal sense of being just about, like, day-to-day life. And there are stories that have something of actual political dimensions, and things blow up occasionally and there's shots being fired. But they tend towards being very low-key and even kind of very aware of the mundanities of real life. There's a lot of, is it bathos when it's like the reminder of the realities coming into what would otherwise be a super dramatic moment?
Yeah,
old-time literary term.
And I feel like there's room for that kind of story right now because the market has been inundated with superhero stories for a while now. If you're going to keep them going, like, you need to find a new angle.
Yes.
They can't all be about, like, somebody, you know, somebody gets superpowers, they fight somebody with very similar powers, and then they're, like, on top of an exploding thing in the third act.
And then everybody cheers and claps as they come down. No, I mean, the very first issue of the Concrete miniseries, I think, kind of really shows this because this is how he meets Larry. He's interviewing for people to be a personal assistant. And then he gets an emergency call from his old friend, the senator, who says, hey, there's been a cave-in in a mine in Kentucky. I think you could go down there and help out because you're kind of perfectly suited for it. So he flies down there immediately and he starts digging in. He starts clearing out rubble and he doesn't need much light because he's got these incredible eyes. He manages to first rescue a couple guys who get brought out, but then he keeps digging and doesn't find anything. And people are getting more and more worried. And then eventually there's another cave-in and Concrete is now buried. And there's no hope of finding him or getting him out because he's so deep. Then they discover the bodies of all the other miners who have all died, although I think they at least died quickly. And then finally, like 12 hours later, Concrete digs himself out because he was able to kind of throw himself ahead of the cave-in and so forth, and then dug around backwards. Anyway, and now by this point, everybody kind of hates him because he was only able to save two guys, and they got all his hopes up, and all the TV cameras have left, and it's very depressing. I mean, that is a little bit of a thesis statement for the book. It's a little more, I would say it's a little more sort of cruel than a lot of the other stories tend to be. The other stories tend to be, if anything, I mean, they're aware of the necessity of reality and what actually stories will end up being like in the real world.
The thing that I like is that they're not, you know, there are shows like, I don't know, like Veep or Silicon Valley, where every single episode is, they have an idea, it's going well, and then everything goes to shit because they're fuck-ups.
Yeah.
And it's not that. It's not like everything always goes wrong, Concrete screws everything up. But it's also not like, yay, the hero wins every time. It always lands somewhere in between. Like, yes. He doesn't save everybody, but he does save those two guys.
Yeah. And there are other instances where he manages to make some particular goal, but for some reason or another, it doesn't quite turn out. Or he does succeed fully, but nobody really appreciates it except him and a few of his friends. I mean, it's a very, this is a word that comes up a lot when people talk about Concrete. It's a very human comic. And I mean, in several of the titles of the stories, even had the word human in them. The most recent miniseries is called The Human Dilemma. And I mean, Concrete is, you know, a person for whom his humanity has been taken from him. And now he's sort of working overtime to regain its sense of connection to the rest of the world. And so there's a lot of stories that focus on this level of human connection and this ability to understand each other and become you know, and really be part of a community rather than just be a freak on the outside of it.
Well, he's almost a character like Spock or somebody whose like lack of humanity makes him more human because
I haven't thought of that, but he's a Data character. He's a very Data.
Yeah.
He does. And that's the other thing. I mean, he does obviously have all his emotions, but it's very hard for him to express them because his face is just basically like two eyes and a mouth on an otherwise blank slab of concrete.
Yeah.
I mean, I find, and the other thing that's sort of necessary to understand is that Concrete does, this is another way that he contrasts with Hellboy. He's a very introspective character. He's always like in his own head and he's always narrating his thoughts. And Paul Chadwick understands this and sort of, there have been stories that kind of prick at his overblown self-importance or his, you know, constant, you know, weighty thoughts. There's a sequence where Larry and his latest date are, you know, going to meet Concrete and he says something like, oh yeah, watch. And in like 5 minutes, he'll remember something. He'll have some melancholy memory and then sink off into silence. And when he does, I'll just kind of give you a nudge in the ribs. And of course, then 2 minutes into the conversation, he sinks off to a melancholy silence. Right. Larry's nudging her in the ribs. It's very like, Concrete is a character also for whom, you know, you can occasionally make fun of him. You understand that, like, yeah, you're a self-pitying dude. We get it. You don't have any genitals. Yeah, okay, that's something. But, like, there are, you know, Paul Chadwick isn't afraid to sort of take the piss out of him, as the Brits put it, and sort of give him a gentle ribbing every now and then as a character. And I appreciate that a lot because it would be very easy to just have him be, I don't know, a constant figure of I don't know, revilement with occasional moments of great heroism or something. I don't know. The other comparison that people often make, always for obvious reasons, is the Thing from the Fantastic Four, who's very much in the same category, you know, a giant rock man. He's not human. He has all these troubles with, you know, fitting in and so forth, but he's living in a world of superheroes. So it's a little more easy for him to fit in. Whereas Concrete is the only person like this in the world.
Yeah. Yeah. And also for Thing, he's like constantly saving the world from Dr. Doom or whoever.
Right. And he gets his tributes. He gets his day in the limelight.
And also has a very clear sense of purpose that like, oh, the world needs me. I think even one of the terrible movies that they made, he finds a way to turn back into a human form and then realizes like, oh wait, no, the world needs Thing. I have to go back.
Right. Yeah.
Whereas, Concrete has to kind of make his own purpose, which is a very human thing. Like we all have to sort of figure out what we want out of life and give our own lives meaning.
Exactly. Yeah. And Concrete is someone he's very much, I mean, in those first issues, he makes that video appeal where he's like, tell me what I can do to help. And what he ends up doing varies quite a lot. Like it's, you know, oh, our family farm is having trouble struggling, you know, making it to the next season. Can you come down and help us plow these fields? Or actually, so some of the miniseries illustrate this even better. My favorite of the miniseries is one called Fragile Creature, which is, I think it's the fourth volume. The producers on a sort of mid-range kiddie action film called Rulers of the Omniverse realized that they could save a lot of money on their special effects if they hired Concrete to do stuff like throw rubble around, like lift up giant boulders and do, you know, practical special effects things along with it. And this is also, this ties heavily into Paul Chadwick's background. In addition to being a comics guy, for many years, he was like a production designer and art director on films. He was, I'm trying to look it up on IMDb right now because I realized I was going to do this and I didn't. But I know he was somehow associated with like Pee-wee's Big Adventure. And I believe he was on the He-Man Masters of the Universe movie. So he's very, like, he knows how these movies are put together. He understands how, he also, I believe, did storyboards for the Matrix movies. He had some deep connections to that one as well. He also did some other things with the Wachowskis afterwards. Yeah, I mean, he has been involved with movie production in a lot of interesting ways. And so Fragile Creature is all about, like, how a movie gets produced from stem to stern. And it's really informative, and it's also sort of the least necessary to have Concrete there. It could just be the backstory of a movie, but it's a refreshing perspective to have him hanging around and, you know, giving his thoughts. I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe this is how you do this. And, you know,
yeah, and I'm sure he has all the details right.
Yeah. And that one also gets to show off a lot of Chadwick's really more out there artistic innovations. He gets to do, you know, cool, weird alien costumes and effects for this movie that doesn't exist. But that's possibly my favorite of the volumes. I think it's the most well-realized of the stories and also has a really strong artistic component. But yeah, I mean, Concrete, like, he's gone some interesting directions story-wise. There's another one called Killer Smile, which is definitely in the running for my other favorite one, which is all about Larry, his assistant, getting accidentally pulled into a crime spree where they force him at gunpoint. These two criminals force him at gunpoint into being the driver for this hijacked car. And he spends the rest of his day basically trying just to survive because then the police think he's one of them and then they're hunting him down. And it's essentially just sort of a bizarre sideways crime movie And talking about like sort of bathos of taking the piss out of things, like Larry's inner thoughts, 90% of that book are the fact that he really has to pee and he constantly can't, like he's constantly thwarted from finding an opportunity to pee. And so there's this constant sort of undercurrent of like the reality pressing in on this stuff and why this, you know, this is not a movie. This is where people have to pee every now and then.
Right, right. And that's what the book does so well. It just finds these human moments.
Yeah. It's very human. And that's as good a segue as any to talk about the other characters as well, because Concrete is obviously the major figure in all this. But the two biggest side characters are Maureen Vonnegut, his biologist, specialist, scientist person, and Larry, who's his personal assistant. And they start off seeming like pretty flat characters or pretty stock characters. Maureen is a scientist with her head kind of constantly in the clouds, or rather constantly on concrete, thinking about the biology of it. She doesn't seem to have much interest in like romance or anything in the real world. She's always thinking about what the weird science of his body. Whereas Larry kind of comes off as not a would-be Lothario, but he's always sort of falling in love with like the girl to wherever they go. And he's always got, you know, his eyes on, oh, this is pretty chick over here.
But he's also kind of an awkward nerd.
Yeah, he's a very awkward nerd. And he's also a would-be novelist. Like he starts off and he's got this terrible novel that he keeps telling people about, and they're always immediately bored to tears by it. But they both gain a lot of depth over the course of the series in a cool way. And like Larry, for example, after his near-death experience, you know, he gets more serious about his romantic relationships. He starts having, you know, different thoughts about what kind of legacy he wants to leave behind. He becomes a much more mature character in a lot of ways. And Maureen, I think, goes through an even more interesting development, because for a lot of the early stories, she comes off as like, there's a lot of sequences where, you know, some guy will make a leering pass at her and she'll kind of either pretend not to notice or just sort of brush it off, or, you know, seem like she doesn't understand what's happening. But as the series goes on, in Fragile Creature, actually, there's a romantic subplot for Maureen where she falls in love with another scientist and also has to maintain her security credentials, so she can't actually tell him what she's working on. And she's shown to be a very, you know, she has her own interest in romance. She's a sexual being. She has her own story and very sort of carefully protects herself from this. In the introduction to The Human Dilemma, there is a line where Chadwick says something about, I've always thought of Maureen as someone ambivalent about the attention brought by her beauty, who developed a spacey obtuseness as a defense. And that's a pretty good read on it, because she's someone who you start to understand that when she doesn't hear somebody making a pass at her, it's a very conscious choice on her part. She's aware of her beauty. She's aware of the fact that people are going to be hitting on her. And she just kind of has learned to refocus her interests and, you know, take herself somewhere else. But at the same time, she again has this fulfilling romantic relationship. She has an ex-husband who shows up every now and then. So I like Maureen a lot. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a thoughtful take on, because I only read the early issues, and so she is kind of the flat character.
Yes.
But like male comics writers are not famous for writing female characters with subtlety and grace.
That's true. That's extremely true.
You know, but that's also a very like kind of human realistic take on what her life would be like.
Right. She understands the attention that her beauty brings, but she's learned through the course of her life how to handle it in one of a dozen different ways. So I like Maureen and Larry both a lot. And they, like I said, they come off as more flat earlier on, and they develop a much deeper, I don't know, they develop in various different ways that make them more interesting to read about, and different counterparts to Concrete, who kind of stays the same, to be honest. He's the one who observes all these changes in the people around him, you know, befitting the fact that he's sort of the eternal observer and never the interactor.
And it's also interesting, like, that reversal in that, like, he doesn't really change. He doesn't necessarily have a character arc. It's just these sort of episodes of him trying different things. Mm-hmm. But another thing that I think makes Larry a very good character, like, he hires him to be his personal assistant because, like, he has these big, like, rocky hands that he can't.
Yeah, he physically can't type things up. Yeah.
Yeah. But that's the thing. He can't type things up. And, like, he very much wants to tell his story and wants to tell stories, and he can't write. So he dictates a lot of things to Larry. But so many stories have, like, the exposition character.
Yeah.
Who's like, what's happening? I don't understand. And then it has to be explained to them.
Yeah.
But Larry's like the reverse of that. He like absorbs all the exposition.
Yes. I mean, a lot of the stories are narrated from sort of a vaguely omniscient third person view, or it's, you know, there's no narration at all and it's just sort of things happening. But yeah, Larry is not sort of the clueless newcomer who gets brought. He, at the very, very beginning, he is, because the very opening of the first issue is him, you know, going to get hired for this job. But almost immediately, he becomes just part of the crew and has his own perspective on things and is very, I like his energy a lot. He adds a good amount of spice to this three-person dynamic, which does, I mean, that's one of the challenges when it comes to casting, is then you have literally just like three recurring characters. There's also characters like Senator Douglas, who keeps showing up every now and then. And there's a filmmaker who Concrete works with every now and then. But there's not a huge cast, or rather, there's not a huge cast that would be recurring from, like, if you did this as a TV show from episode to episode.
Yeah, that was something I've been thinking from the beginning, that, like, it often comes up on this show, like movie or limited series. And this is so episodic, partly because of its nature as a comic, but also the themes and the sort of plot. Like, there is no, you know, villain. There's no world ending stakes here. It is just kind of he tries a bunch of different things with varying degrees of success. And that just lends itself so well to a series. I don't know what you would do if you had to do like 1 2-hour story about Concrete.
Right. When I told you that I wanted to do something about Concrete, I mentioned something about my dislike for origin stories. And in this case, particularly, because I had a brief exchange of emails with Paul Chadwick when I was in college and I was writing to him about this comic. And I sort of asked him about, you know, the necessity of having the aliens in there. And also in one of the introductions to the books, I think he writes about this as well, that, like, yeah, the aliens are sort of a necessary evil. You have to have a reason to have a normal dude become a giant concrete guy. There's no easy way to do that in an otherwise realistic story. So aliens, like, aliens are sort of the acceptable enough solution to that problem. And, you know, the aliens completely, you know, zip off into the skies after their first and only appearance and are never heard from again, because they're just not part of the story. And Concrete is a character for whom the origin story is frankly not as important or as interesting as a number of other things you can do with them. And in fact, I completely forgot I was going to mention this until I got to this point. In another of the Concrete book introductions, he talks about, I believe he's talking about the fact that they're making another Fantastic Four movie at this point, because I think this is the third one by this point.
And
he's disappointed because they're just going to be doing the origin story again. And he's like, you know, the origin story for the Fantastic Four is not great. Just drop us into their world, make a bunch of background references, like, oh yeah, the Skrulls, we fought them, or oh, Dr. Doom up to his old tricks, you know. But don't bother with, like, the cosmic rays. And I mean, the origin story for the Fantastic Four is so stupid and goofy. It's like, hey, the world's greatest scientist, the world's greatest military pilot are going to go up to do some experimental rocket tech. And also, we're going to bring along the world's greatest scientist's girlfriend and her kid brother, because we wanted to have four characters. Like, it doesn't, stupid. It's like, it's not, the origin story is not great.
I will say, like, the MCU, when they brought in Spider-Man.
Yes.
They did his origin story in a 30-second conversation with his friend. Like,
yes.
They know we've seen this before. They know we don't need to see it again.
Right. For a lot of heroes, I mean, it does depend on the character. Like, I feel like, for example, Doctor Strange, for starter, is for one thing, he's not a very well-known character. He's not as well-known as Spider-Man. But that's a character for whom the origin story is pretty important, because you understand, oh, he was an arrogant man who had to learn humility and had to relearn how to be sort of a real person again after this massive tragedy. That's a pretty good narrative, and it also ends up shaping who he is as a character overall. There's a blog post I keep thinking about by a writer named Christopher Bird, who did a blog post talking about a potential Flash movie back when that was still considered, but a dream impossibility.
Right,
like, who would ever make a movie with the Flash? And, like, for someone like Doctor Strange or even Green Lantern, like, you have a character where the origin story is actually kind of important, because it's a great man kind of broken and made humble and having to relearn what his place is in the world. But the Flash, like, if you know anything about comics, the Flash's origin story is, hey, I'm a dude. One day I got hit by lightning and chemicals. Now I can run really fast.
And
I fight, you know, Gorilla Grodd. I don't know. Like, there's nothing particularly interesting in the origin story. That doesn't mean that you can't have a good Flash film, although I think evidence hasn't really been strong on that score yet either. But, like, that just means that you don't make a story about the origin story. And in Concrete's case, too, the origin story doesn't tell us anything about Rod. It doesn't give us any particular insights into his character. It does shape what kind of character he is from then on, but only in that he has experienced a massive change and is still living with its effects years on. So the origin story is completely unnecessary, and yet you do have to explain it somehow. You do have to explain why there's a dude who's 8 feet tall and made out of concrete living in Los Angeles. Like I said, there have been a couple attempts to make movies or TV shows out of it. Okay, so in the original 10-issue comic series, there's like 3 issues of Concrete's adventures doing other stuff, like a swim across the Atlantic Ocean, and then they do an issue where Concrete is like, all right, Larry, well, you want to know where I came from? Here's the real story. And then he tells, you know, the story about the camping trip with Michael, the aliens coming back and meeting with the senator, and then they kind of just keep going from there. One of the later volumes, one called Strange Armor, is this retelling, sort of expanded retelling of essentially those first few issues of Concrete based off of a potential movie treatment. So it's still the origin story, but sort of intertwined with a lot of those early stories from around that point. So like the cave-in story, for example, is a big part of it. It adds a couple of things. It changes some details. It expands some parts. It adds a character who is very clearly like the villain. It adds an NSA guy who is trying to make Concrete into like, oh, we can turn him into a one-man army.
Right.
Send him into the bush to hunt down drug dealers, you know, stuff like that. And he is like, there's a big explosive climax. Stuff gets broken. Concrete more or less ends up in the same place as the status quo. But like, you know, you have your big, gigantic explosions along the way. It is more mainstream. It still isn't what you want it to be, because Concrete shouldn't have that big, gigantic, explosive storyline. I don't think there's a reason to make him into something big like that.
And also like, oh, the military wants a super soldier. Like, that's a story I've never heard before.
Right. I think they didn't they just do that Deathlok movie that completely flopped, like a failed souffle? That was another government super soldier thing, you know? Yeah, it's not a particularly interesting story. It doesn't tell us anything about Ron as a character that we couldn't, you know, glean a dozen other ways. And, you know, and there's just there's no meat to it. So when we get to it, are we finally getting into the hypothetical movie pitching at this point? Should we switch gears to the what it might be like?
Yeah.
So what I was envisioning is a much more kind of picaresque bit-by-bit story. I mean, a lot of the Concrete stories, like I mentioned, are either short stories, like 8-page things, that are very little, not even fables, short stories, just, you know, little side bits, fragments along the way. I think that would be a good model for a movie. You have to have some sort of framing story around it. And there's a couple ways to do that. One would be, this is, oh, his old friend, the filmmaker, wants to make a documentary about Concrete. So he's following Concrete around and sort of recording all these events. And so it's a movie within a movie, as it were. And so we get to see some of these incidents from both Concrete's perspective, as well as the filmmaker's perspective, how they're sort of trying to change his image or do this or do that. And that would give us an opportunity to do a lot of these stories in either an abbreviated form or just tweaked a little bit. You know, maybe he does a brief stint on a movie backlot as part of the story. Maybe he goes on a road trip to climb a tall mountain somewhere else, something like that. But like a road trip story where he's being filmed as a in sort of a documentary format seems to make a lot of sense to me. And of course, you start off with Concrete and Maureen and Larry already being an established trio of characters. They know each other. They've been working together for years now. And then somewhere along the way, Concrete will say to the filmmaker, hey, you know, I trust you. I'll just tell you my, you know, where I really came from and all that stuff. And he does an abbreviated form of his origin story. And that, I think, is the best way to do it, because there's so much to these narratives that is just, it's so minuscule and so human in a way that I just, for an example, like my absolute favorite Concrete story is one of the 8-page short comics. Concrete is going off to spend a few days sitting in the desert, just kind of staring up at the stars to sort of recharge his creative batteries. He's sitting up on top of a you know, small mountainous plateau out somewhere in the desert, staring up at the stars, when he notices a car driving down this otherwise completely deserted middle of nowhere desert road. He sees a guy park it, get out, kind of look around furtively like he's hiding something, open the back trunk and pull out what looks like a body bag and dump it in the scrubland and drive off. And Concrete, of course, is immediately like, oh my God, this guy could be working for the mob. I should take, I need to note his license plate. He's like writing down the license plate because he can see it from like 3 miles away. He's, you know, getting his description. He's noting the time. And then he's imagining to himself as he climbs down the mountain to sort of get to where the bag has been dumped, he's like, oh, you know, they may be able to call me to testify, but what if the mob starts coming after Maureen and Larry is, you know, what if they're threatened? I can't take that chance, but I have to. And he finally makes his way to the bag and he you know, carefully zips it open and it's full of junk food because the guy's gone on a diet. So he's throwing away his Twinkies, potato chips. And Concrete just kind of goes, well, you know, good for him. And that's it. That's the story. It's 8 pages. It's done. It's funny. It's, you know, it's pricking at his self-importance. It's just enough to kind of give you a sense of who Ron is as a, you know, an over-imaginative, well-meaning guy. I like that a lot. Incidents like that should be interspersed throughout the movie if you're doing a movie as opposed to a TV show, which honestly, I think a TV show would also really work and maybe even is a better choice for a lot of reasons.
I think if you do a TV series, you can use those 8-page stories either as sort of the B story or as like a cold open or an incident within that you weave in. Like there's another one that I liked where there's a bunch of kids who keep kind of teasing him
Yes.
And it starts off being cute, and then it becomes annoying. And so he turns the tables on the kids and scares them. And then it could end with him like, was I just a huge dick to those little kids? But like that can just kind of be a scene within, you know, within a larger episode. You just weave that into one of the longer stories and kind of have them pop up occasionally.
Yeah. And occasionally characters will come back like that too. There's a somewhat recurring character, an artist whose name is, I think her actual name is Melissa Strangehands, who is obsessed with painting concrete and has never met the guy, but just paints hundreds of pictures of him constantly and sends him like slides of her painting so he can look at them. And every time she writes him and sends her slides, she'll ask if he wants to pose for her. And every time he says, oh, I love your paintings, but I'm sorry, no. And there's one little short comic where we follow her around as she, you know, mails off another set of slides. And finally, for the first time, actually meets him in person where they're like walking past each other on the street and he steps out of her way and that's it. But like, that's another little background character to just have around is, oh yeah, Miss Melissa Strangehand sent you another bunch of slides. Take a look. And you know, but yeah, concrete is really well suited to having those little incidental moments along the way that, you know, they give you a rich texture. They give you this texture of a guy trying to make his way in the world. And there are other people out there too, doing their own thing. And concrete is just a part of their world too. So yeah, something like that. And because of that, when I was trying to think of filmmakers, one of the names that came first to mind was Chloe Zhao, who one of her bigger projects was she did one of the MCU movies. She did The Eternals. But before that, her big movie and the one that I saw first was that movie Nomadland.
With
Frances McDormand. Yes, which is phenomenal. And it's such a quiet movie. It's all about, you know, Frances McDormand is this widow whose husband just died, and she decides to basically live life on the road, become a nomad. And apart from Frances McDormand and another actor, is it David Strathairn? There's another actor who's like another guy who she meets on the road and sort of has a relationship with. Apart from those two, everybody else is just an actual person who lives like this. It's just part of the traveling nomad community. And it's sort of almost documentary, but not quite. And there's lots of beautiful scenery, just absolutely gorgeous, you know, images at national parks or on the road. It's very, very true to life, very humanist. And it reminded me a lot of kind of the feeling that I want from a concrete movie, where it's, you know, it's made up of the little moments. It's made up of little moments with people just sort of interacting and having interesting conversations on the road. And there's no big villain. There's no big moral choice at the end. There's no gigantic confrontation. It just, life is made up of 1,000 little moments. And that's what I really liked about that movie. And even The Eternals has something of that elegance to it. It's, you know, it's a Marvel movie. It's kind of doing its own thing, but it's, you know, it has a certain visual element to it that I liked as well.
So. Yeah, I actually thought Chloe Zhao was a great and very interesting choice to direct a superhero movie.
Yeah.
And that one just didn't come off very well. But I think like maybe if she had done something like Logan that's a little more focused on one character stands apart from the rest of the sort of superhero world.
Yeah, that's good. I hadn't thought of that. I had completely forgotten about Logan, but I mean, I love that movie too. That's another interesting comparison because it is superhero technically. But it's on the edges of it in a way that makes it something a little bit different.
And those are the stories that are interesting to me.
Yeah. Concrete being a strong guy or a guy who can swim across the Atlantic or climb Mount Everest, that's cool. Like, you've got moments for big special effects. But what makes it interesting is, you know, the journey up that mountain or across the ocean or, you know, what happens along the way. So,
well, my biggest thing as a writer is that, like, it's great to have an interesting plot or an interesting hook for the story. But the only thing that matters at the end of the day is the character.
Yeah.
The plot has to illuminate the character in some way. It either has to show you who they are or it needs to change them in some way. Like, you have to kind of build the plot around the character and the setting too. And like, what do these things tell you about the character? What do these things tell you about the human condition? And so all these incidents are really just an opportunity to like kind of spend time with Concrete and who this guy is.
Yeah. And build him up and sort of understand who he is in a broader sense. And yeah, I mean, when I think of him as a character, I mean, that's sort of that slightly spacey, very well-meaning, but, you know, he likes to imagine things. He's a daydreamer. He's a, you know, he has a broad mind, but he's also, you know, prone to depression. Like, he's a very richly imagined character in a way that's really crucial to have for a movie like this that has this undercurrent of weird magical realist whateverness to it. Yeah.
Well, when I was thinking of director, I was thinking more of TV because I kind of from the very beginning thought this should be a series.
It really should. I mean, I think it could make a good movie, but a series makes much more sense.
Although when you were talking earlier, I thought maybe you just get Paul Chadwick to direct, given that he has a film background.
Honestly, it could be done. And he also has a lot of connections with film people. I forget the specifics, but I know he's like in one of the introductions again, he talks about working with this person and this person and this person. And, you know, he has he certainly knows people who are talented filmmakers. So
yeah,
I'm sure he could do a good job too.
I mean, he storyboarded The Matrix. He certainly like no slouch. Yeah. And then I also, this is a little too on the nose, but Melissa Rosenberg, who was the showrunner for Jessica Jones.
Oh, because yeah.
That's also kind of a superhero story that's far more interested in the character and her experiences.
Oh, completely.
And, you know, her powers aren't that interesting or even terribly helpful a lot of the times. Like, she's super strong and she can kind of fly, but not really.
And she kind of sucks at flying, yeah.
Yeah, but that's the thing. Like, she's somebody, you know, it's a lot more of a dramatic story than this. And there is like a villain and stakes, that sort of thing. But she is like somebody who's like more powerful than the average person, but she also kind of sucks.
Yes. Yeah, and that's concrete in a nutshell too.
You know, Kristen Ritter was just perfect for that role.
Yeah.
It's so good. Oh, one of the things, like my wife said at one point, we were watching the show, she just looks like she kind of smells.
Yeah.
And like, yeah, like you, she doesn't have the character so well. You can like sort of smell the booze and the fact that she slept in those clothes.
Oh God. The comic series, I don't know if you've read the comic series too, but like it's very true to the spirit of that comic, because there's like one of my favorite issues of the original comics of Jessica Jones, which they were originally titled Alias, but they retitled it to Jessica Jones because there already was an Alias show. Anyway, there's a whole issue where it's her just going on a date with another like kind of B-list superhero guy. And it's just like an actual normal date. They don't immediately have some soul connection, but they're also not like awful to each other. They kind of have to, you know, take each other's measurement. They have to kind of go back and forth a little bit. There's a little bit of, you know, giving up information. How much do you withhold? Like, it's a really memorable issue in a series that otherwise has, you know, explosions and weird psychic battles and shit. Like, no, I like the issue where she's just on a date that kind of goes bad at first, but then gets better. You know, like that's a really memorable character to build a series around.
Yeah, so, I should go back and read those comics, because I love the show, but I also, and this is just a very specific to me, but I had like a love-hate relationship because I had this idea for a novel, which is about a troubled borderline alcoholic superhero who doesn't really know how to use her powers to help things and wears a leather jacket and her parents were killed. And like all the details, I was like doing the last pass of edits and starting to look for agents when Jessica Jones came out. I was like, this is the same.
This is character. Exactly what it, yeah. Oh, that sucks. I'm so sorry.
Yeah. And,
it's a good idea though.
It's called Self-Destructible. You can order it from your local independent bookstore and it's on Amazon, but that was frustrating. But, you know, like there's no original ideas. It's just your take on things. So I did think of that Jessica Jones as being, the tone's not quite the same, but there's some of that like down to earth, kind of mundane
reality of
the fantastic person. Yeah. But then I came up with another idea, which isn't quite so on the nose, but I kind of like a lot. Donald Glover to both direct and star.
Ooh, no, I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah, but I was trying to think of like shows that are down to earth, but also a little surreal.
Yeah.
And the first one that came to mind was Atlanta.
Of course, yes.
Yeah, yeah. But then Donald Glover also, like, he's a very good everyman.
Yes.
And he also likes superhero and genre stuff. Like, Miles Morales came about because Donald Glover wanted to play Spider-Man. And then Brian Michael Bendis was like, well, let's do a Black Spider-Man. And so, you know, he'd be on board. And as far as directing and starring, it's really a voice role.
Yes.
You know, he just has to sit in the booth and say, I'm Groot. And so, it's not overtaxing. But I feel like this is kind of halfway in between him wanting to be Spider-Man and Atlanta, which was focused very much on like the mundanities of this guy's life, but also these kind of surreal touches.
That's interesting. Ah, oh, man, I hadn't thought of that at all. For me, like, I will say, I couldn't imagine Concrete as anything other than white, because characters in the comic kind of point out that he's got sort of a white, he's not quite a white savior type, but he's someone who's like, always thinking of how can I come in and help in a way that's a little bit, it's very social justice warrior-y in a way. And there's I don't remember if that's in the volume you read or not. There's another story where Concrete is hired sort of as a publicity stunt. He's hired to be the bodyguard for avant-garde rock and roll star Duke, who is in no way based upon any existing, you know, pop stars with a name based off of a title of royalty. And just sort of about the weird foibles of celebrity and this, you know, this kind of odd guy who wanted to have something. And I believe that's the story in which this character says something like, I thought she might be black, but there's no way. You're completely white. Like, he strikes me as a white character in the sense that he is someone who, you know, he has a white guilt complex. He feels like he should be doing something more to save the world in a lot of ways. And although he now has a different way to do it, he definitely is still trying to sort of save the world from environmental predation and, terrible violence and so forth. And it's Donald Glover being the voice of him. First of all, I think the voice could do it. It's I don't know.
I sort of felt like, you know, it's a comic from 1988. Everyone in it is white.
Yes.
You don't necessarily have to be beholden to that. And I also think the savior thing you're talking about, like, it's one thing that's interesting about the story to me is that, you know, he has this feeling of with great power comes great responsibility.
Yes.
Except Peter Parker just happens to be walking by a bank robbery on his way to work, like, a couple of times a month. And, like, that's not how the world works.
Right. He's actively seeking out things to do.
Yeah, yeah. And I also think, and as far as that goes, it's kind of a good story for the 2020s because, you know, a lot of comics like the 70s and 80s, there was a lot of crime.
Yeah.
Back then. And even when Marvel Comics started in the late 60s, crime was on the rise. And so crime fighter was like a thing that the public, you know, really sort of wanted and needed. But despite this sort of a lot of public hysteria about crime, this is one of the safest periods in all of American history right now.
Right. There's a lot of
crime. So then what do you do? And this didn't occur to me until I was researching for this episode, but none of the MCU superheroes fight crime.
You're right. They fight like giant world-ending threats.
Yeah, but it's terrorists or aliens or a shadowy version of the superhero, which is almost every, like, the Hulk fights like another Hulk and Iron Man fights a guy in a metal suit. And they never switch it up. The Hulk never fights a guy in a metal suit.
There was like one scene in Spider-Man Homecoming where he's fighting those bank robbers. But no, I get you. I get your point completely.
Yeah, and that is kind of baked into the cake with your like friendly neighborhood Spider-Man.
Right.
No, but that's kind of the only crime that committed in the MCU that isn't by like a, you know, shadowy organization or something.
Yeah, they're getting funded by the Vulture and his tech crew of science do-batters. I was going somewhere with that. There was this American perception that like, oh yeah, gangs in this very nebulous form are everywhere and doing all this crime. And so we were all very terrified of them. But of course, the reality was something very different, and it's vastly overblown. And
well, this is getting way off topic, but I'm right there with you. You see people posting online about how like gang violence, which is just a racist canard, and like it's part of this like, all right, Donald Trump ran for president in 2016 on our cities are on fire, crime numbers like we've ever seen. 2016 might have been the safest single year in American history in regards to crime.
Yeah.
But everybody bought into it because there's this persistent idea that cities are dangerous hellholes, mostly propped up by people who have never set foot in a city.
Yes.
Like one of my favorite pastimes, like I've lived in or adjacent to New York for like 26, 27 years. One of my favorite pastimes is letting people online tell me what New York is like.
Yes. Oh my God. There's like a picture of a tweet that was sent around months ago, where it was someone talking about like how to survive New York. And it's like, wear shoes that are always made for running. You never
know.
Yeah. It's just like the most ridiculous, like you could be mugged at any minute. Anyone on this street could be a killer. And it's like, good God, have you ever actually lived in a city? Like, have you ever seen a black person on the street? My guy, it's a racist fear mongering overblown hype. I mean, I also think about, for example, the fact that there was this enormous media hysteria over like the shoplifting epidemic and how there are gangs of shoplifters coming in and just clearing out a CVS in an hour. And then, of course, all these numbers have come out that said, actually, no, this is entirely made up. And they were lying about every part of this just to justify high prices and increase security. So like, yeah, no, there's this, the ways in which crime and lawlessness are constructed in the American media are and have always been a trash fire for a variety, a racist trash fire specifically, in a lot of ways.
And it would be interesting to do a superhero story that kind of takes it on directly.
Yes.
But that leads to the concrete problem of like, how do I use these powers? Because if the real issue is the Target and CVS are lying about shoplifting to justify their sort of shitty corporate behavior.
Yes.
Then like, how does being able to, you know, throw boulders at people help that? The real problems are like systemic problems that like I can't really do anything about.
Yeah.
And it's the old canard that like Bruce Wayne would do more good if he just like gave a lot of people jobs.
Yeah, there's a debate towards that. And a friend of mine, Chris Sims, who's another podcaster who absolutely loves Batman in every form, has said the response to this should always be, well, he lives in a world in which there are killer monster clowns who poison the reservoir every other week. And that's who he should really be fighting. But it's there's a bad faith argument to be made about what superheroes should be like and how effective they would really be and so forth.
Right. And at the end of the day, the answer is it's just a story.
The answer is I want to see Batman punch some monster clowns in their faces. You know, exactly. Like, that's that kind of story.
So let's get back to the cast.
Yes.
Who did you have for Dr. Maureen Vonnegut? Because I didn't, because I read the early ones, I didn't have a great handle on her. So I didn't have anybody for her.
Right. So this is actually where you mentioned colorblind casting. This is where I was thinking, oh, Larry and, well, and even Larry less so, because Larry is another person who, he's a white guy with an overinflated sense of self-importance and like loves to constantly be hitting on the ladies. I thought he also should maybe be played by a white guy to have that, you know, what's the joke about, you know, give me the confidence of a mediocre white man.
Oh, that's absolutely Larry.
Yes. So we'll talk about Larry in a second. But Maureen, when I was thinking about Maureen, I mean, for starters, I started to think of like, oh, who's other, you know, redheaded actresses? Because she's, you know, got this famous flowing head of red hair. And I was trying to think of like, oh, well, I love Melissa Leo, but I'm pretty sure she's out of the acting game by this point. You know, Julianne Moore is maybe a bit old. I was trying to think of other actresses. But then I realized, like, when I would think of Maureen, what I mentioned earlier, that idea of her being someone who's very canny about how her appearance, you know, she's very beautiful. Like it's emphasized that she's this incredibly beautiful woman and she understands what that means to other people. And she's very sort of careful about how she presents herself. And so what I was thinking is you really want to have a character. I mean, first of all, you want to have a beautiful actress, which I mean, there's no shortage of that in Hollywood, but you want to have an actress who can portray somebody who is interestingly gray or has give a real depth to a character who otherwise might seem to be something of a, you know, a pretty flimsy character. And I realized that actually what I was thinking for that character would be Lupita Nyong'o, who, I mean, for one, obviously she's beautiful, but also, I mean, she has this, you know, those beautiful, large, luscious, dark eyes. I mean, she looks like a Disney princess on the screen.
Yeah,
but she's very good at playing interestingly complex characters. I mean, I first went to thinking about Us, which is not my favorite Jordan Peele film, but boy, howdy, is it worth thinking about and rewatching every now and then. It's a fantastic movie. And she portrays two versions of the same character who have, you know, an interesting contrast of not quite good and not quite evil, but are inverse versions of each other. And there's moral complexities to it. And she does a fantastic job with it. And that's, I think, what I really want out of Maureen is somebody who could appear to be just sort of disarmingly beautiful and charming. And she doesn't quite realize how beautiful she is. And then you realize, no, she's had her own history. She has her own desires, her own, you know, perspective on the world, and is a really thoughtful and interesting character in her own right. And that's really where I think you could have, you know, Lupita Nyong'o being a great actress. I know I'm not exactly shocking anyone with that hot take. Like, I think that would be a really good.
I like that a lot. And it's also like, it's interesting to have a black actress in that role because there is kind of a certain amount of code switching.
Yes.
Where she kind of has this carefully constructed persona
that
changes based on the situation. And I say this all the time on the show, like speaking of like Lupita in Us, that anytime an actor plays two subtle variations on the same character and the same thing, that always blows my mind, even though that is the entire job of an actor.
Right. There's somebody who already is pretending to be somebody else. Now they're just doing it several times over. But yeah, no, it's incredible because they're having to portray, just a little bit of a variation on the same theme over and over again. I mean, I haven't finished Orphan Black, but my God, Tatiana Maslany in that.
Oh, yeah.
She's phenomenal in that because she's playing, you know, seven or eight versions of herself by those last few seasons. It's incredible.
Yeah.
But yeah, Lupita Nyong'o just kind of stuck in my head because I mean, for starters, I want to see her in more things. I like her a lot. She's a phenomenal actress. But also, like, she has both the look and the ability to sort of use that look as part of her character in a way that I think would be really true to who Maureen is as a larger character. So,
yeah.
For Larry, I don't know. I was having trouble thinking of who I would want to have in that role. I was thinking maybe somebody like Andrew Garfield, because I like Andrew Garfield. I like to see him in more things. He's a little too handsome. He seems a little too sure of himself.
Yeah.
I don't know. I do like him a lot. And I that's sort of a thing about just, I don't want to see him in more movies. Why not cast him in my imaginary concrete adaptation?
And that's exactly what this podcast is for.
Exactly. It's self-indulgent in all the ways. I don't know. I couldn't really think of anyone else because, I don't know. I mean, you do have to have a guy who is sort of the mediocre white guy distilled into perfect form.
Well, I think I have that guy distilled into perfect form in Christopher Mintz Plasse, who the world will forever know as McLovin.
Oh my God, I never saw that movie. I know Super. I never saw Superman.
Okay, but he's the like quintessential like, you know, nerdy white guy with like false bravado that masks very transparent insecurity.
Yeah,
and he did that really really well as like a teenager in his early 20s, and then he hasn't been getting that much interesting work.
Oh, just looking at him, though, I can definitely see, like, oh, my God. Yeah, I think he has that. Yeah, I see.
And granted, I talked about, you know, actors being able to do different things, and this is just casting them exactly to type.
Sure, but
you know, sometimes that works for a reason.
Yeah, because yeah, I mean, Larry, he acquires depth over time. He comes off as both kind of a windbag and kind of a, you know, overly has an inflated sense of his own importance, or at least, you know, he's trying to be a mediocre novelist and that kind of thing, but becomes someone more mature and interesting as the course of the series goes on. So it's, yeah, I know, I could definitely see that. For my Concrete, so when Concrete is in his human form, I imagine he kind of has to be the biggest schmuck. I always imagined him as, oh Lord, what's the actor's name? He's in Succession. He's Cousin Greg.
Oh, I don't know the actor name. I just know him as Cousin Greg. I think that's all you need to say.
Is it Nicholas Braun? Or no?
That's really funny. Actors.
Yes. Nicholas Braun, he has something of the most schmuck-ish look. And I feel really terrible. Nicholas Braun, if you're listening to this, I'm so sorry. I love you as an actor. But I do think he comes off as kind of a schmuck.
Does really well as an actor.
Yes. So that's who I thought of as human Concrete, who, you know, we would see once or twice at the beginning in like the origin story recap. But for voice acting, I mean, it is almost entirely a vocal role. You could do some interesting things with, you know, digital sound effects and so forth. But I mean, one of the things that I think about whenever I imagine Concrete speaking is he has a very deep, profound chest voice in my head. He has to sound like a very deep, prominent, you know, authority, a guy you will listen to as a reasonable authority figure, even if, you know, he's sort of a schmuck on the inside. I think that's sort of an important dichotomy for him to have, is that he's still kind of a schmuck every now and then, but he has this incredible voice. I'll tell you right now, when I was reading the comics, whenever I imagine him speaking, it's the voice of Peter Cullen from Transformers. He's Optimus Prime.
Oh, right, right.
Which, Peter Cullen is in his 80s. He's not really doing the role so much anymore, unless they force him to with piles of money. But like, I don't really think he should be the voice of Concrete for a variety of reasons.
But somebody like that.
Somebody like that, with a very deep chest voice, a very, you know, authoritative, booming chest voice that you will listen to. And there are a couple different options. The people that I was thinking of, there's, I don't know if you ever played the Mass Effect games, but the character of Erdnot Rex is a very deep-voiced alien, played by an actor, I believe his name is Stephen Barr? Let me double-check this. Yes, Stephen Barr, who hasn't done a lot, but he has an excellently deep, very gravelly voice, which fits for Concrete. And again, you could do a lot of that in post, but I feel like as much as possible, you want it to be a real voice.
Yeah, yeah.
The other person I had in mind is someone who is known for having a deep voice, but hasn't really gotten to use it much outside of comedic context, is Patrick Warburton.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Yeah, you know, Putty from Seinfeld, or Kronk from Emperor's New Groove, or a dozen other things.
And the live-action Tick, he's done superhero stuff before.
Exactly, yeah. He is the deep-voiced guy in a lot of different contexts. And to the best of my knowledge, I kind of went back through his IMDb page, and he's primarily a comedic actor. He has done some dramatic turns, but I would love to see him given the opportunity to play a primarily dramatic role, and a character for whom... Concrete can be funny, as I've mentioned. He can be kind of, you know, made to be a figure of fun because he's, you know, self-important or whatever.
But he's more of like a wry sense of humor to this than...
Yes, very wry. You know, the scene where he unzips the body bag and it's full of Twinkies and potato chips. Like, that's a delicately wry moment of humor.
Yeah.
I would love to see Patrick Warburton try that, because I just like to see actors out of their comfort zones in general. But, like, I feel like he could do great things with it, so...
I also feel like a dramatic role with like a little bit of humor to the character is maybe easier to do for a comedic actor. You know,
that's
like
fair,
you know, like putting a comedian in Better Call Saul, I think worked better than putting a dramatic actor would have.
That's true. Yes.
You know, it's that kind of thing.
Those are my primary choices of casting for Concrete, and then also in general. And then there are other, like I've mentioned, there are a couple other recurring characters. There are people like the Senator Douglas, who I think it'd be kind of neat for him to be sort of a modern day Bernie Sanders equivalent.
Oh yeah.
In the comic, it's not shown very much what his positions are. I don't even know if they say what state he represents. Maybe they do. I forget.
I think it's all deliberately vague.
It's very vague. He's just Senator Douglas. He's an older white haired guy. He could play some critical roles at points. I'd like to see him be played by, what's his name? Bogosian. Eric Bogosian.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Mostly, I like the guy, and a friend of mine is working with his son on a comic. So,
oh yeah,
yeah, it's a nepotism thing, really. but I like Bogosian a lot. He plays a good, older statesman type. In fact, he played that very role on a couple episodes of Succession. So, and then there's a filmmaker character who shows up once or twice in the comic, who in my version of the story would be not quite a linchpin, but someone who kind of helps drive a lot of the plot and could ask the stupid questions every now and then. And also, crucially, could be the person to whom Concrete tells his origin story at some point.
Right.
And that could kind of be anybody. An older filmmaker who at first is a little full of himself, gets a little more humility, would be relatively off to the side of the whole thing. But that's our whole cast, pretty much. I mean, the only other major character who's appeared in more than one or two stories is Concrete's dog, Tripod. Yeah, he's a three-legged dog, of course.
I figured, yeah.
Yeah, I think he might show up in that first, maybe in the second volume. He's adopted.
I feel like if you name a four-legged dog Tripod, you're asking for trouble.
Yeah, that's eventually down the road. It's going to happen. Like, yeah. just don't name him Monopod and then move. But yeah, like that's pretty much your entire cast. And it just depends on having a really good cast that can bond and do a really good job of these characters who might come off as very flat. I mean, Concrete is, I think, very easy to stereotype as well as a very kind of depressed, mopey guy who just sits around and thinks sad things all the time. I don't know how much you've read of the more esoteric works of Alan Moore. In one of his books, Promethea, there's always that background character of the comics of the weeping gorilla. Like anytime you see an advertiser for a comic, it's like the weeping gorilla. And it's literally just like one panel of like a gorilla crying as it thinks like, what about all the dying babies in Sudan? And like that kind of thing. And like, I think Concrete could very easily be that character. He's just always sad about something happening in the other parts of the world. But I think, you know, when you scratch the surface, he becomes, so to speak, that's an unintentional joke. When you get down into his character, he is much deeper than that and has a much more interesting role to play. So
I think it translates to deep down him like having these abilities and not really knowing how to use them in a way that makes a difference.
Right. Yeah. The things that he does do very well. I mean, he does gangbusters on the special effects for He-Man, but that's just making a kind of crappy mid-budget movie. Which, I mean, like I said, I like that one a lot because it's one where he ends up being pretty much entirely successful and he enjoys the movie despite it being essentially kind of a 90-minute toy commercial. But like, there's some good stuff in there. You know, there's some fun to it. He's had this experience of bonding with these crew members and it's like, it's a reasonably happy ending. Yeah, like not having him do anything truly important is crucial to this. He doesn't save the world. He doesn't solve world hunger. He does occasionally make stabs at tackling bigger sociological problems, but it's made pretty clear that he's still just one guy, even if he's 8 feet tall. So,
Yeah.
So that's Concrete in a nutshell. I mean, I would highly recommend anyone who's interested in interesting character-driven comics, particularly of the early 90s. The books are, if not still in print, at least pretty widely available. Again, even if they're not in full color, at least they're a pretty good reproduction of his art. And if you really want to track him down, they're out there. The other advantage, by the way, of making a TV show is that you can really start anywhere with it. Like, the status quo of Concrete, once it is set, is pretty much that's what it is for the entire series. You know, he lives with Maureen and Larry. He travels around the world. He has strange adventures, that kind of thing. The final book that's been produced to date, The Human Dilemma, actually does introduce something that's a pretty major change to the status quo, but there haven't been any comics since then. So we don't know how it's going to change the status quo. So it's
okay.
Kind of a Schrodinger's cat thing at the moment. We don't know.
And I kind of imagine with a series, you kind of throw the audience into the middle of it and have an adventure of the week. And then at some point you do the backstory. But like once you've gotten to know these characters.
Yeah. I mean, again, speaking of, we talked about The Matrix earlier. The Wachowskis also made that movie of Speed Racer, which was kind of widely agreed to not be a great movie. But one of the things that people often said about it was that they made the right choice of literally just dropping us into this world in which, yeah, racing cars is not only the most important sport in the world, all those cars have like spring-mounted jet booster, you know, tires that can launch into the air and do flips. And like, yeah, that's just how it is. Don't question it. That's the world. We don't have to do a backstory. That's just the world that we live in. And like, that's the best possible choice you can make for those series is like, yeah, there's an 8-foot-tall concrete guy in Los Angeles who kind of tries to save the world, but he's kind of just a schmuck. Like, give us these characters and let them go from there.
And I like the only kind of nod of the origin story in the very first issue is his cover story is that he's like a cyborg built by the government. And basically nobody believes that.
Yes.
And nobody believes that. That's obviously made up.
Yeah. Because like, why would the government build an 8-foot dolled up man made out of stone for like covert infiltration? So nobody believes it. But at the same time, there's no real benefit in believing or disbelieving anything. So it's like, yeah, whatever. You're just a guy. We'll accept whatever you want to do.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's Concrete in a Nutshell. It's one of my favorite series. I would say it's a bit of a cult classic. I compared it to Hellboy earlier, and it certainly doesn't have the reach that even Hellboy does. But it's, I feel like Paul Chadwick is one of those ones where if you did any, you know, reading of comics in the 90s, you've probably heard of him. And his art, again, I can't emphasize this, as much as it is a great story told well, his art is also really phenomenal. And it's worth getting some of those full issues, if only for that, because they're beautiful cutaways to look at on the page and things like that.
So. Oh, yeah. All right. Well, that's our movie. Thanks again to Ted Anderson. Yeah, check out pleasure. Side Effects, The Spy Who Raised Me, and his other comics. And you can find him on Blue Sky at Ted Lee Anderson. And go back into the archives, listen to the episode from the first season of this podcast where we pitched a Jack Kirby biopic, which was a fun one.
That was
If you have any thoughts on indie comics, building materials, or ideas for other movies that need to get made, hit me up on Blue Sky at Mike Vago. And you can read student journalism, reviews of Star Trek Lower Decks written by me, hear college radio, and listen to other lesser podcasts on our parent website, subjectmedia.org. We'll be back in 2 weeks on...
Why is this not a movie?